Once a month, we visit with our partners at the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology for a segment we call Underground History. Chelsea Rose and Mark Tveskov of SULA bring in people and stories about archaeology and the intricate and fascinating process of truly unearthing the past. This month, we talk with someone challenging the orthodoxy on a story of the region's history. That orthodoxy holds that Sir Francis Drake in the late 1500s stopped to repair his ship in California, probably present-day Marin County. Melissa Darby at Portland State University recently completed a book making the case that no, Drake could well have landed in Oregon. Melissa Darby is a visiting research scholar in the Department of Anthropology at PSU and is a private consultant in cultural resource management. Melissa, thank you for joining us. Melissa Darby, are you there?
Great to be here. Can
there we
me?
Go. Yes, there we go. We just had to patch up a little bit. Okay. So good to have you here. And then Chelsea Rose is back in the studio with me once again. Always good to have you.
Always good to be here.
So Melissa, start us off. Your work tends to be about the indigenous people of the Northwest. Is that what led you to Drake in the first place?
Yeah, exactly. I've always considered the Elizabethans interesting, though, as well. And this was a voyage by Francis Drake, who I didn't know much about, but I knew that he was an important figure. I'm a reader of sea novels and mysteries, and as an anthropologist working in Oregon, I also am very interested in the native peoples, the first peoples who were here. In fact, I'd like to acknowledge that I am living in the territory, the ancestral homeland of the Chinookan people, and that the people I write about are the original people of the central and southern Oregon coast, and they include the Coos, Alce, Siuslaw, Lower Umpqua, Upper Coquille, Shasta, Costa, Chetcoat, Tutuni, and the Tolowa, and also the Rogue, Klamath, and Modoc. So I had to get that out there, but you know, I have a varied background and interest, and so this was sort of a lark, studying the Elizabethans.
and so lay out the circumstances, I mean, of the orthodox story that Sir Francis Drake was traveling around the world, and what were the circumstances that led him to the west coast of what became the United States?
Well, he had just raided and pillaged a lot of South America, Chile, Panama, parts of Mexico, and he was on a mission with for Queen Elizabeth, and so he had... His ship, the Golden Hind, was full of gold and silver and pearls and emeralds and things that he had stolen from the Spanish. And they were on the far side of the world. There was no help for them here, and their ship was leaking. And they had to get north because part of his mission was to reconnoiter for the Northwest Passage. And historians found this document in the 20s, and it pretty much laid out his plan or the plot of the voyage. So he came pretty far north, probably 48 degrees north. The ship had been in a storm. It was a summer storm. This was in June of 1579. And they needed to find a bay that had a sloping, sandy shoreline that was protected from the waves, and so they scouted and they found a bay and careened the ship and stayed there maybe 5 or 12 weeks. It's inconsistent on the reports, but there were 80 men and a pregnant black woman named Maria made landfall in this bay. It was described as a fair and good bay, and they unloaded their treasure and they met the Native Americans, and their cultural observations were pretty naive, but I believe I've made a case that they were meeting people who lived on the central or southern Oregon coast.
Well, yeah, for the folks who know their geography pretty well, when you drive through Salem, you see the sign for 45 degrees north. So we're talking 48 would be north of that. So when you describe the sloping sandy place, they basically were looking for a boat launch, a place so they could heel the ship over and work on the leaky parts.
Yeah, their ships were designed to lay down on their sides so that they could clean it. They didn't have dry docks everywhere, and these wooden ships, you had to have stations. Known stations where you could tip your boat over and clean off the bottom and recalc it all. And they had a leak, and they needed to get to the leak. They had partially careened it when they were in Mexico, but they didn't get all the way down to the freeboard area. So they needed to get ready to go across the Pacific. This was the second circumnavigation of the world. And Drake had no choice. He couldn't go back through Magellan Strait. Of course, he didn't find the Northwest Passage. They had to go across the Pacific. They had to get the ship ready.
This is Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. Melissa Darby from Portland State University talking to us in 2019 about Sir Francis Drake in 1579. Where did he put ashore? The official story is California. Her new book, Thunder Go North, The Hunt for Sir Francis Drake's Fair and Good Bay, says more likely it was around Depot Bay, Oregon. We'll get into the details. We also have Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology in the studio for Underground History, as always. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Questions, comments, welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. It sounds like they were a lot more focused on the ship than about the surroundings, but how carefully were the days of the voyage documented by either Drake or anybody else on this ship?
Well, when they got back to England, Queen Elizabeth confiscated Drake's logs and maps. And then they were never allowed to be published. They did publish a small official account of the voyage, but his original documents were disappeared, and they probably burned when the palace burned down in the 1600s. So they're just lost. So we have a carefully written history of the voyage that is pretty much propaganda by Queen Elizabeth and her ministers. And it kind of shades where they went, and then it's not very clear because they were in a Cold War with Spain when Drake was doing this. And they didn't want Spain to know everything, where Drake had been and so forth. And I also make the point in the book that they wanted to claim as much land as possible. Even though the Native Americans, this was their land, and this was the first colonial strike for the Northwest Coast, and we've got to acknowledge that.
Thanks for the reminder about Spain, too, because this is just 9 years then before the Spanish Armada attempted to attack England and failed.
Right. They failed, and Drake was a big part of the Armada and the victory there.
And this was proprietary information because they thought they would come back and expand upon what he'd learned, not necessarily because anybody was foreseeing the situation we're in today.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, you know, when I started this book, there was sort of a double helix that I was unraveling. The modern story of how all these historians and anthropologists were looking for where Drake landed, and then the story of Drake and what he did. And so the other part of the story that I had no idea that I would come across this is who made the Drake plate of brass. The plate of brass that was found in San Francisco Bay in 1936 and shown to a prominent historian who said, oh, it's authentic. Well, there's been various theories over the years, including one, I think, in 2002, that they said, we know who made the plate of brass, and it was a joke hoax. But I stumbled across is that actually the historian that authenticated it, Herbert Bolton, was the one that originated the plate of brass to stop the theorists who said that Drake was further north, including two women, Zelia Nuttall, an anthropologist who said that in 1915, that Drake was further north, and she traveled to Cape Flattery and wrote a whole manuscript that never got published about where Drake landed. And then in the 30s, Eva Taylor, a historian from England, said, look, we think that these new documents I found show that Drake was further north. And then, boom, the plate of brass was found to shut all this theorizing down. And everyone thought the plate was real until 1977, or some people said they knew it was a fake, but it was officially declared a hoax in 1977, which reopened the question. But historians didn't go back and reinvestigate because they thought it was already settled and it was kind of a, you know, a moot point for a while.
Have you seen the two manuscripts that the women wrote?
Zelia Nettall's manuscript was lost in World War II. She went back to Mexico and died in the 30s, and her daughter and son-in-law took it to London, and then during the Blitz, their house was bombed. It's gone.
Wow.
So. It's gone. But Eva Taylor's work is published in various things. She has two books in the Mariner's Mirror articles, and they're just not known out here very much.
Well, it seems, you know, I have to introduce a question here about the fact whether because they were women, it was easier to dismiss the claims of Zelia Nuttall and Eva Taylor.
Yeah, Zelia Nuttall, she was a strong woman. She went to a suffragette school in London, studied all over Europe, could read old Spanish manuscripts. Spent 20 years in the archives in Mexico City. She was just a fabulous archaeologist. She, I don't know if you've heard of the Nuttall Codex. She found that. But strong women with suffragette leanings in 1915 were not accepted by the white male history establishment.
And even though her manuscript's gone, do you know any of the maps or anything that caused her to rethink or to put forward that?
Yeah, I was really lucky. In the Bancroft Library, I found note cards that she made that went with her displays for the speech she gave in 1915 at the Panama Pacific Historical Congress conference. So I have an outline of her arguments in the maps, and I present that in the book. And then I have some of her letters and some of there was a biography written about her that's never been published. It's in manuscript, and I found that. It's also at the Bancroft Library. And the writer details her search for Drake and so forth and how she was shut down by the California historians who didn't like this new theory because Drake was their golden son, right?
Surely, how fervently attached is Marin County to the concept of Sir Francis Drake landing there? I know there's a high school named after him in San Anselmo, and I imagine you haven't been asked to pep rallies there.
No, there's some advocacy groups that have really been pushing for recognition that Drake was in California, but they're not trained historians, or most of them aren't anyway, and They're a booster group, and you know, they've been throwing rocks at me. And I just decided when I started this just to go back to the beginning, just start at the original documents, what they said. I'm not going to go out on any tangents that aren't supported or any conjecture that I can't back up. And so I was going to write a very narrow, straight ahead, what is and what isn't. And so, because this was a vexed question. I mean, in California, they argue among three different Bay advocacy groups. There's two different ones on the Oregon coast. There's one in Washington and one on Vancouver Island. And all these clubs or groups, you know, have websites and they put out pamphlets and I just thought, well, let's cut through all this and just be professional about it and see what it is, see what it is.
So, this is Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Melissa Darby, a visiting research scholar at Portland State University's Anthropology Department. She is the author of Thunder Go North, The Hunt for Sir Francis Drake's Fair and Good Bay, which postulates that he probably landed in Oregon, closer to the 48th parallel of latitude and not the 38th, which would place him in Marin County, California.
44. He went up as high as 48, okay, and then came down looking for a bay and landed around 44.
Okay, that is. I appreciate the correction. So Melissa Darby's with us on the phone. Chelsea Rose from the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology back with me for Underground History. You can join our conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org.
So, Melissa, as an archaeologist, you bring a new set of tools to this argument. So what do you think that archaeology could contribute that would be the smoking gun or the legitimate golden plaque or brass plaque?
A true brass plaque.
No, there's been a couple of things found. There was a coin found at Nehalem Bay, but I couldn't trace it down. I couldn't find the owner, or the owner wouldn't respond to my questions. But that can't even be verified. So it was found on the beach. We don't know the provenience. Maybe some coin collector dropped it. So I don't know what we can do archaeologically to find any physical evidence of Drake. I know that when I was in England and I looked at this one manuscript called the Harley Manuscript, I looked at it from the paper and the ink and the different colors of ink, and so I looked at it as if it were an artifact, and I figured out, this is one of my important findings. I figured out that this Harley manuscript was actually a draft of the chapter of the official account, and it was done before the censor got to it. And so I said, look, if this is a draft, and the printed version says they were at 38 instead of 48, then this measures what was censored and what wasn't. So I figured out that the original manuscript said that they were up at 48 degrees, and they landed around 44 degrees, and that they changed it so they could claim more land from the boundary of Spain north, boundary of the Spanish colonial holdings north, so that they could check Spain. So that's what I brought archaeologically, is looking at things, the physical thing, and what it really means. But and I think archaeologists have found things out of context or deeper that are dated older, and they just say, well, it's from a Chinese junk. So maybe we need to relook at some of those collections and not dismiss things so quickly.
Because some of the stuff that they took off of the ship when they were there for 5 to 12 weeks could have presumably ended up into the hands of native peoples and
passed down
that way.
Like metal, I'm assuming metal, and I know that they gave out glass beads to other people, like when they were on the coast of Chile, and when they were in Indonesia. So there could be some things like that. It's going to be elusive. It's going to be hard, and I hope it doesn't turn into someone's Oak Island kind of crazy stuff. But
explain the reference, please.
Well, there's a TV show where these people are looking for treasure on the East Coast on an island called Oak Island, and it goes on and on, and they find things, and as a historian and archaeologist, it pains me to see.
So is it worth, Melissa, doing some digs? I mean, Whale Cove, you propose, is one entirely possible place. This is pretty close to Depot Bay, and it's right at 4444, I see.
Well, I'm not interested in doing any more digging. I don't know. I think it would be a needle in a haystack. I mean, you know, we've looked for Lewis and Clark at Fort Clatsop, and we have not found one shred of evidence there. And they were there for, you know, the whole winter. So, and there was a tsunami that wiped the coast in 1700.
Oh, sure.
And I just think that if you start down that path, you'll become obsessed, and I'm not going to go there.
So more digging would maybe be the archives.
Yeah, I think the archives. And I think that, you know, maybe in collections that we already have, we should relook at some of those.
So I want to get a little further into the cultural things. What was said in the accounts by the British that might indicate things that resonate with what you know of the cultures that existed on that portion of the Oregon coast at the time?
Well, one of the things they said, the Drake Chronicles, Fletcher, his chaplain, they wrote that the people they met had canoes, the anthropologist in California that was writing about this, Alfred Kroeber, he was troubled that the watercraft that Drake described was canoes, because the Miwok and Pomo of the Drake's Bay area and the San Francisco Bay area don't have canoes. They have little small boats of grass that look like the bulrushes of the Lake of Mexico, according to explorers that came later. And then the houses of the Miwok and Pomo are mat houses. Sometimes they throw seal skin on them, and they're just dug a little bit down in the sand. But Drake said the houses, let me see if we can quote, houses are digged around within the earth and have from the uppermost brims of the circle clefts of wood set up and joined close together. So he's talking about semi-subterranean plank houses. Now, there were not semi-subterranean plank houses around San Francisco and San Francisco Bay. So this is really clear that they were somewhere on the northwest coast.
So just about a minute left here, okay. Melissa. So where does the debate go from here? I mean, at the moment, is your work against the entire Drake Navigators Guild?
Well, I'm going on a book tour. I'll be in Berkeley in February and New York in January and L.A. later on. And I'm going to the SAA meetings in Austin. And we'll just see. I'm maybe someone wants to debate me. I don't know. But I'm just presenting my work, and they can present their work. I'm not going to fight anybody.
Has the book been published yet?
Yeah, it came out in October. Mm-hmm. It's available from the University of Utah Press.
Okay, the book is
www.uofupress.com.
Okay, the book is called Thunder Go North, The Hunt for Sir Francis Drake's Fair and Good Bay. It's the work of Melissa Darby, visiting research scholar at Portland State University's Anthropology Department, private consultant in cultural resource management, and our guest on this month's Underground History, with our usual guest from Sula, Chelsea Rose.
Great.
Good to have you here, Melissa. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Chelsea, see you next month.
All right. See you next month.
That'll do it for this hour of the Jefferson Exchange. We'll visit with Aaron Tan and pipe organ music in hour number two coming up.